Welcome to Emotional Sobriety. I heard a term the other day, lucky attachments. Forming enough lucky attachments will pull you towards your purpose. And I think that makes a lot of sense to me in recovery, because if you're doing it one day at a time, and if you're doing it in cooperation with other people, and you're just kind of like, you're holding firm to that mindset of do the next right thing, then eventually over time, you know, those units will combine to produce kind of like whatever the purpose project is. You know, like you always say, it's the only insight is hindsight. And so building those lucky attachments on an improvisational level, you know what I mean, in sobriety.
I always say, I think the conscious mind thinks it has to be involved in everything, and it really doesn't. It really is, it does sometimes, but ultimately it serves a purpose as an observer and somebody who uses that hindsight, like you were talking about, that kind of puts the story together. But the other thing I'm thinking about with this is something I hadn't thought about in a long while. I'd written about this years and years ago. It's that when you're setting goals, just it's sufficient at certain times in your life just to have the goal of direction. It's like, you know, maybe I don't know where I'm traveling to what specific place. I'm going to go north. Okay. That's what I'm going to do. Go like, well, where there are so many places you can end up north, you know, it's like, and it's like, and if we include northwest, northeast, all this, it's like, okay, but I ask people sometimes with early recovery, are you going the direction you want to go? Are you going the direction you believe you need to go? You'll figure out, you'll specifically find where you're going to be and where you want to be as you go along, but you don't, because I think sometimes we can get, this is part of the conscious mind thing, it's in a way we get hung up thinking we have to know a lot more about what we're doing before we do it. You know, and if there's a lesson that I was a drunk as a clinical director of an alcohol and drug treatment center, it's like, and doing the work, it was like, I definitely was not in conscious process with that. I was pretty sick. This is how denial is, how ridiculous denial is. I used to go down to the Stockyard Lounge and drink at the Stockyard Lounge here in Nashville. And I would give people who seemed really drunk my card because I thought they might need help.
Beautiful. You know, when you talk about your experiences during this period of your life, trying to dole out the counseling while you yourself were sick, I was in day treatment, like an IOP program, around 2016, 2017. I was in a program called Relapse Prevention. It was a group that met twice a week. And I really enjoyed it, and I really loved the counselor, and he was doing inner child work and, you know, all this other stuff. And there were the people that I was befriending there were starting to get some more significant time. You know, they were coming up on a year or 2 years, and I just couldn't stay sober. And eventually they gave me the boot. Oh, let me just add a little seasoning to that story is I had started to look into getting like fake urine so that I could piss clean and not be found out. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I just really liked the group. I liked that positive energy. And I could intuit that this was like a scene that I should be around and that I could find some kind of place in. But I just like, I was not able to stay sober for the life of me. And eventually they kicked me out. And I was so incensed at that. I was just like, you know, that's your job to keep me sober. You know what I mean? Like that's why I keep showing up. And
how dare, right? Yeah.
But I love the group though. I love the group, and they had something I wanted. I feel like I was looking at them through the glass, and I could feel the warmth on the other side of the glass, and I just wanted to be close to that. And but there's a ticket for entry, and I was not paying the ticket. So yeah,
we love you, but it's like, you know, rules are rules. You know, and some of them are good ones.
when you talk about recovering from assholeness after recovering from alcoholism, see, I always conflate that with emotional sobriety. It's that second level recovery, right? That becomes your journey towards emotional sobriety. You know, as if Alan was sitting on our shoulders right here. You know what I mean? Let's make that the discussion for the last leg of the show.
There's 12 steps of recovery. And this is just sticks in my mind. One of them, he says 12 steps. One of them mentions alcohol. You know, it's the whole step's not even about that. It's like it's a mention. It begins with a mention of alcohol. He said the rest of it, see, and that's emotional sobriety, what Bill was meaning from the beginning. The rest of it is how to be a better person. You know, that's emotional sobriety. I mean, see, that's the thing I've gotten since we've been doing this stuff, and we're working with Alan, this with the podcast and the is we're just finding a language to put on this that makes it clearer and easier to convey to other people. But it's not different. It's like, it's what we've all been doing. It's what Alan was doing too. He's been working on being a better person. It's like, you know, he didn't stop at putting the cork in the jug. You know, he's like, none of us did. And it's like, so we have something to call it. I mean, I used to say to people, I would say, what do people do who aren't alcoholics or who aren't addicts? Because I got to a place midway in my recovery where I was going like, because everything I've ever learned that's valuable, I learned because I fucked up and was in this program. You know, so what do people do who aren't fucking up? How do they learn? It's like, you know, and emotional, I said, there should just be one big A, you know, just whatever, just anonymous, you know, and this is what emotional sobriety is. It's one big A. It's like, yeah, no, everybody fits. You just need to find your way of understanding yourself from this point of view. And it's because that's what it is. It's a way of looking at ourselves.
To that question, you know, it's like, where do the other people go? I find myself thinking, the women that I'm attracted to, or that I find myself kind of coming together with in relationships, are women that I also seem to have some fundamental incompatibility with. And I think that's a common problem. That's a common struggle that a lot of us have. But then on the grass is always greener, I'm always looking at what the high school sweethearts or like the people who did manage to kind of like find a person that they reached a reasonable level of compatibility with, where every day doesn't need to be a kind of like some kind of struggle of like fitting the square peg. Yeah. And you know, just taking the pieces of your life and kind of like fitting them together into some harmonious structure. It's a different layer.
What do people do who don't have the 12 steps? It's like, you know, now I understand. No, we're messed up in all kinds of ways. So it's like, and I know there's all kinds of ways better. You know, it's not all, you don't have to have 12 steps. But if you look at any of these, the principles of programs, if you look at Buddhism, if you look at 12 steps, if you look at any of this stuff, if you look at, I study Stoicism, it's all the same. It's just different words.
I found myself talking to a lot of normies this last trip out of town that I took. And I was answering a lot of questions about addiction to them. And I felt good about being able to just describe, you know, I feel like every year, you know, I get a little bit clearer in like the way that I can break it all down. And you know, it's good for people to be aware of, you know, like what the sick people walking amongst us are really up against. If people understand each other just a little bit more, then change is possible.
Still to this day, when people talk about addiction or alcoholism, they think about late stage gamma. I think it's in Jelinek's point of view, gamma alcoholism, one of many kinds of alcoholism, in which there's physical addiction, where if your brain gets just a whiff of alcohol, you're lost in all that stuff. I don't have that brand of alcoholism. You know, my addiction is I mean, there's physical connection. We have hangovers. It's a psychological addiction. It's like in lots of different kinds of addiction. So a lot of times the system for people will go, they will go like, well, I'm not living in the street. I'm not in the gutter. I haven't missed work. I haven't lost a job. Me neither. I never did any of that stuff. You know, I slept I locked my door and took naps in my office more times than I can count. But it's like, no, I didn't. And I never got in trouble for my job. That it's like people need to know that, no, this stuff, first of all, like any other illness, you want early intervention. You know, and what we wait around for, what historically we've waited around for is, oh, let's let it ride until it gets real. Then we'll do something.
I don't see how mine could have been caught any earlier. I needed to hit that cement, you know what I mean? Or that's kind of like, you know, where I've landed on it is, I needed to just erase all, erase all doubt that I was who I was. Maybe we could just kind of wrap up in 10 minutes with what's the emotional sobriety trial du jour? What are we working on at the moment maybe we could offer some experience, strength, and hope in communicating to our people?
We only control our mind. It's like how we interpret what's happening to us and how we respond to that. That's it. And so anytime I go back to Bill Wilson's letter we read all the time, and you know, when you're in distress, if you look closer, you will find unrealistic expectations. He doesn't say look closer because there might be unrealistic expectations. He says the closer there are. And there are, and it's like, it's, you know, and Alan talks about that at the beginning of every workshop, of how, you know, we, from that letter and from his own work, that, you know, as long as we're trying to get the world to cooperate with how we want it to be, or how we get people to do that, we are, we're volunteering for powerlessness. Yeah. You know? And it's like, but the good news about that is when we take this wisdom, this one, I can control me. I can control my thinking. I can, you know, and I put it into practice. It's like, in the moments I'm doing that, I'm not saying that everything is wonderful in the world or I'm all happy and this stuff, but when I'm doing that, I'm okay. I'm fine. It's like, my integrity is intact. My self-respect's intact. I may not like what's going on, but, and I have, and part of my power is I can express that. I can let you know how much I don't like what's going on, but I can do that in a way that doesn't imply that I'm waiting around for it to change because I want it to change, because that's not how it works. What do you think?
Yeah. It's delineating pain from suffering. I always think about when Herb would say that. My thing was I loved alcohol. I loved opiates. I loved pot. And because I wanted to maximize my happiness and minimize my whatever pain I may have been experiencing, mm-hmm. because in my assessment at the time, you know what I mean? That was the mark of how well I was doing, you know, just how, right. how pleasurable is my life walking around in this moment versus mm-hmm. Displeasurable. Mm-hmm. And now the calculus has shifted a lot, where, I could feel pretty good even in my unhappiness, because I've just got a stronger foundation, and it's, I'm not making my wellness contingent upon how much pleasure I'm experiencing in this moment.
Absolutely. I got that from one of my early groups with eating disorders. When I asked a young woman at the beginning, how are you doing? And she asked me this question back that has changed and shifted the big thing for me that I've had it shifted ever since. And I said, how are you doing? And she said, are you asking me how I'm feeling or how I'm doing? And it was, I mean, she didn't have to say anything more than that. I mean, I got that. I think the whole group got that at that point. But then she went ahead and answered the question. She said, I feel like crap. She said, I'm doing really well. You know, and what we ended up talking about that day was she felt like crap because she's doing really well. You know, it was brand new to her. She hated it. She didn't, you know, you're talking about loving opioids. She loved her eating disorder behaviors, and she was abstinent from them. It's like, and she was choosing to do that. And she understood that's where her self-respect, you know, was. It was like, no, I'm doing the right thing. And it makes perfect sense that it feels like crap.
You know, when you watch like movies about love stories, does your relationship to those movies change now that you're in a more recovery, emotional sobriety kind of mine does too. Okay, so I saw that movie, it's called Queer. It's based on a William Burroughs novel. William Burroughs was a junkie and alcoholic and stuff like that, but a brilliant, brilliant writer. And it's Daniel Craig in Mexico City in the 1950s. And it's about him, you know, like looking for love in all the wrong places, or maybe all the right places. I don't know. But like, it's about his like tortured romance with a man that he meets there. And anyway, like the first section of the movie is just like, it's such a vivid, like he's just throwing down drinks, you know, at the bar and just like stumbling around Mexico and shooting heroin and, you know, just doing everything he can to numb out. And the way I saw it, kind of, maybe there was a past version of me that would kind of look at his self-torture as like, what he really desires is, you know, he just needs that. He needs to find his other, he needs to find that connection in another person. Because he just feels so isolated and alone. And the solution to that is going to be in the arms of another person. Whereas now watching it, I'm just like, well, no, it's just the person that he's looking for is just an extension of these other outside, the substances, you know, just the sun on his face, you know, when he goes out, on a nice Mexico day. And there was just a kind of like peace and an emotional sobriety, for lack of a better term, that, you know, that he couldn't name, that he was trying to locate, you know, in his day-to-day experience. And the romance that he couldn't get to quite work was just, it was just another facet of the same project. You know what I mean? And it doesn't work out, spoiler alert. There's, you know, he has some beautiful experiences, or, you know, there's some really like, you know, wonderful beats on his journey, you know, towards trying and then failing to get things to work out with this guy that he falls in love with. But, I mean, I don't know. It would probably hit other people watching differently. Because I'm a codependent, you know, I'm a love addict and sex addict and all that other stuff. And you know, I'm still seeking connection. I'm still seeking romance, you know, with someone else. But I no longer view that as like, that is my mecca, you know, like that is the thing that I must. I need to find that and hold on to it for me to kind of like redeem myself, or for me to finally feel whole. You know, like I've disabused myself of that, I think, pretty well.
I love that by putting it, you know, by view something, you remember how you perceive it at one time, and then you perceive it again, and you realize, what's the difference? It's me. I'm the difference. It's like, and you ask me that question, do I do that? It's like, you know, I can even tell you 38 years into my sobriety that when you describe him in Mexico throwing back drinks, My little tequila boy, he's right here, and the romanticizing that I would do with that, I put it aside. No, thank you for sharing, but was the actual sitting in the bar drinking. It's like, you know, I mean, my attachment to, I love bars. I mean, you know, just like people talk about their drug of choice and their light up. I love bars. It's like, and I loved being in bars. And it's like, you know, I was a fucking mess in bars. I just, you know, earlier told the story about, you know, how many times I've been cut off at bars. But it's like, that was so cool to me, you know? And it's like, No, it's not. It's
right, you know, not anymore.
I don't know. This is an old movie that Russell Brand's done a version of it since then. But Dudley Moore did the original Arthur. Did you ever see that movie?
I hear it's really good. The original. I haven't seen it.
It was really good. It was. See, this Dee Dee and I talked about this just the other day. It was really, it was hilarious. It was what Dudley Moore is hilarious. It's like the whole thing is, it was, I think Liza Minnelli's in it. It's like it was so funny. The second time we saw it many years later into our recovery, it was sad. He's just a drunk, you know? And it's like, you just sit there and go, this is horrible. It's like, you know, not the movie's not horrible. It's like it, this man's life is horrible. It's like, you know, and it's, it was, a, it really did interestingly take the fun out of that movie. Yeah.
Yeah. I, but like, boy, do I relate. I mean, I feel like I'm living differently now. But, you feel for those people, you know, my people, you know, just for, but really having no peace or like no real, what Alan would call differentiation, you know, at all. And then not having a sense of myself, you know, who I am independent of all the other planets in my orbit.
Yeah.
And
well, if you're watching that stuff on the tube, so you're at home, I'm alone or with your girlfriend, is like, do you talk to the characters?
Oh, do I
do sometimes? Yeah, I go like, no, don't.
Yeah, I do.
I give them advice, you know. It's like, don't do that. Don't do, you know, it's like.
Oh, you know what's funny? So this is apropos of nothing at all. I mean, except for what you just mentioned. I was on the plane coming back from my trip, and I was watching The Apprentice, that Donald Trump origin movie, which is very good, by the way. I put off seeing it for a really long time, but now that I've seen it, I think it's a great film. But there's a scene where like Trump is going around as a young man collecting rent from like the slums that his dad runs. And he opens the door and the tenant who doesn't want to pay him like chucks like a pan filled with boiling water at him. You know, when he opens the door and he has to do like a Neo like Matrix dodge, you know, to like to avoid getting this hot water on him. And anyway, I reacted. I was on the plane and I was just like, oh, and, you know. And then, you know, the woman next to me is just like, I'm sure she already doesn't like to see, like, you know, Trump on my laptop, you know, next to her. And
you're already ruining her life. Yeah.
So, but yeah, I will have a visceral kind of reaction if I feel like I'm really in the emotional curve of the movie I'm watching. And, and yeah, like I, this has made me the experience of watching that, William Burroughs movie with Daniel Craig makes me want to read more William Burroughs because, you know, it's, I don't know, just the addict experience without like being too much of a drunkalog, because I feel like, I get it, you know, but it's more about like, what is the person inside the addict that's being thwarted? Like, what's the spirit inside that's being suppressed, and how is that spirit's tendrils kind of like trying to reach out through, you know, that.
Yeah, well, so like we were talking about, you know, the people that you and I, the me and you are talking right now. We were there throughout the days of our drinking and drugging, and it's like what we have been recovered. You know, it's like we were there before, we were there during, we witnessed it. You know, we were. And we were powerless. We just sat there and watched, and sometimes knew that there was stuff I should have been doing differently, but it didn't have, hold much weight. You know, I think, well, this is bad. Okay, I'll do it again. You know, and but yeah, and what you're saying is you can see you can imagine the real person in there. It's like, you know, they're in there. They need to come out.
You know? Yeah. Yeah, I would really like to be old one day, you know, like I would really like to make it that far. And that would not be possible if I was living the way that I used to. Right. You know?
Well, I don't know what it's like to be real old, because I don't think I'm real old. I'm 70. But I like being older. I like, you know, the only thing I don't like about being old is just because you, body parts hurt for no reason. It's like, you know, when you're in your 40s, if something hurts, or, you know, for you, if something hurts, it's because you fell off a mountain. It's,
I was just
like,
gonna say,
you can explain that. You can explain it. Like, no, when you get in your 50s, all of a sudden you get out of bed and you go, you know, it's like, what did you do to yourself? It's like, no, nothing. I've just lived for 55 years, you know. It's, but that's the only thing I don't like about it. Otherwise, Yeah, I love being older. It's like, it's, I have a little nutshell around here. It says basically, you have to have two things to be wise, or to have wisdom. That is, you have to stay alive for long enough and you have to pay attention. And that's one day at a time. That's another way to basically describe our recovery. We're staying alive and we're paying attention.
Tend your life. Tend your myth. Cultivate your narrative with whomever you are.